Joining us from the Times, the one, the only, it's Mr. Rory Smith here on World Football Daily. Rory, it's a pleasure to have you on board, mate. How are you doing today?
I'm not bad at all, mate. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. We all were able to survive the storm here in the UK. I hope it didn't affect you too much, Rory.
No, trains were a bit busier than usual, but I suspect people have lived through worse.
Yeah, I think we've all seen probably worse weather elsewhere around the globe, that's for sure. We haven't seen a goalkeeper or an England number one in this kind of worst sort of debacle as Joe Hart finds himself in at the moment. The critics have come down heavily on him after the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think this mistake, the one that cost City a point at Chelsea, it probably wasn't quite as bad as some of the other mistakes. I do think that Ivan Stanisic has to take a degree of responsibility for what happened. Although I would say that the majority of the responsibility lies with Hart. But it's the fact that this is the ninth, I think, someone tallied it up, that this is nine mistakes Hart's made now in the last sort of year since that performance against Borussia Dortmund, which seemed to be kind of his apex as a goalkeeper. And the question is now, what do you do about it? Because dropping Joe Hart is a huge move. It's a huge statement, either for Pellegrini or Roy Hodgson. But by rights, you can't really, if a goalkeeper keeps making mistakes, you can't really play, because it will cost your team points. It's the one position where if you make a succession of errors, you have to be changed. You just can't afford to carry a bad goalkeeper. You can carry a striker who's not scoring goals, or you can carry a midfielder who can't quite get his crossing right. But you can't carry a bad goalkeeper, because it will cost you, and it will cost you immediately.
If Pellegrini drops him, does that mean Hodgson has to drop him as well? Can you not have a goalkeeper as being your England number one who's not playing regular first-team football?
You probably can't, but then I think that the timings might help a little bit, because England have got two friendlies coming up in November, because they've already qualified for the World Cup, which the rest of the world should be delighted about, because they're wonderful to watch. And I don't think Joe Hart will play in them anyway. I think Hodgson will use those games as a chance to play John Ruddy of Norwich and Fraser Forster of Celtic, who would kind of be the two most obvious understudies to Hart, that I think have one international cap between them. They need a little bit of experience at international level, just in case Hart either doesn't recover his form or is injured in Brazil next year. So I think Hodgson can get away with that until February to some extent. But yeah, if it came to it, if Pellegrini drops Hart for Pantilimon at City or signs someone else in January, and Hart's on the bench at City for the rest of the season, which I don't think will happen, but if that were to happen, then that gives Hodgson a real difficulty, because I don't know, it's quite an interesting question, really. Is it better to have a good goalkeeper who's in bad form, or a worse goalkeeper, not a bad goalkeeper, but a goalkeeper who's not naturally as talented, who's in better form? Because I'm not quite sure which way that goes, to be honest. That's a really difficult call to make.
It's a number of people I'm sure would like to see some Hodgson go with a form guy, at least for confidence alone. But for Joe Hart, if he does lose his place at City, does he maybe think of looking elsewhere away from City? And will Pantilimon be given a fair opportunity to take the reins and earn his place as a starter at City?
I don't know. I think that's unlikely. That feels unlikely to me. Pantilimon, he's a Romanian international. He's a perfectly competent goalkeeper. He's enormous, which can't do any harm. But I don't think he maybe has the reputation or the ability to be the number one for a club of that size with those sorts of ambitions. So I think what's more likely, if Pellegrini does decide that Hart has to go, and this is a problem for Hart that predates Pellegrini's arrival. It dates back all the way to Mancini. And as I say, it's been going on for about a year. So it's not Pellegrini's fault. But if he decides to get rid of Hart or to drop Hart, I would expect them to go for someone in January, someone of a higher profile who maybe has the kind of aura that you need if you're a goalkeeper at a top club, rather than Pantilimon. In that instance, yeah, I guess that Joe Hart probably does have to look elsewhere, and that's difficult, because I'm not quite sure where he goes.
What did you make as well, Rory, of the way Jose celebrated that goal going in, and of course the win against Manchester City for Chelsea? It's a big score, and it was a big game for Fernando Torres. There was a lot riding on that emotionally for Chelsea on that night.
There was. It was a real marker, I think. Mourinho has made it very clear over the course of the season so far that he thinks City are the rightful champ favourites for the title, and that he feels that they should win the title because of the money they've invested in their squad. I don't know how much he believes what he's saying, but that's the narrative that Mourinho is creating. He's kind of casting himself as the underdog, putting all of the pressure on City, and of course on Pellegrini, his old kind of sparring partner from Spain. So it was a huge result for Chelsea to beat them. A huge week for Fernando Torres, to be perfectly honest, as he was excellent in Gelsenkirchen against Schalke in the Champions League as well. He seems to be building up a head of steam. And I think it's very dangerous with Torres to say, oh, he's back or he could be back to his best, because we've seen it before and we've seen it fall apart before. But this does feel a little bit different. It feels a little bit like Torres might be... He just looks at... Something has changed within Torres. He looks hungry again. He looks determined again. And I think that is probably testament to Mourinho, and that's what he wants in his teams. He wants his teams to be desperate and determined to win, and that's what he's like. And you saw that in the celebration. My personal view is that he went a bit too far in sort of running across the city bench to get to his son, allegedly. I think that's a little bit disrespectful. I'm not particularly fussed by the fact that Pellegrini didn't shake his hand. I think we should all grow up a little bit. And if they don't want to shake hands, they don't want to shake hands. We don't live in a world of rainbows and kittens and kisses and clouds. You know, it's real life. And if you lose, you don't want to shake someone. That's fine by me. So no, I think Mourinho was a little bit disrespectful. But that is Jose, isn't it? That's what he wants in this team, and that's what he's like. He wants that unceasing desire to win. That's what he's all about.
And it seems that Torres and Chelsea in general are thriving off that sort of Mourinho being back in the last few weeks. Is that what Chelsea have needed? Rather than this, I am the happy one, as you said, sunshines and lollipops and rainbows. Or has it been this, you know, Mourinho back to being this bravado, marching around the touchline that's actually helped kick Chelsea and ignite that fire?
Yeah, that kind of prowling Mourinho with the swagger and he's got a stroppy face and he's complaining and he's kind of... Not nasty is a bit too far, but he's got that little devilish streak in him. Yeah, I think that's important. I think Chelsea need a leader. And the problem they've had in the last couple of years is that because of the vacuum that Abramovich has created off the pitch, and because maybe two or three of the players that they looked to on the pitch have either left, like Drogba, or are ageing, like Terry and Lampard, who aren't as important as they used to be. There's been a kind of a lack of direction. They've had some great games. They've won some trophies. But they've not looked like they're all kind of pulling together all of the time. And I think what Mourinho does is he provides a lightning rod for that. So he kind of instills in his players this belief that they have to win, that it's life or death, that nothing else matters. And that kind of engenders this unity in the squad. And I think that's what you're seeing. You're seeing a Chelsea that, for the first time in a long time, is kind of thinking collectively rather than individually.
Is he going to be pressing that sort of attitude tonight when Chelsea take on Arsenal? London derby, but it is only the Capital One Cup where we see, obviously, these sides play reserve teams on a number of occasions.
Yeah, it's going to be a really weak team from Chelsea. Juan Mata, the World Cup winner, will play. Willian, the £13 million Brazilian, will play. David Luiz, who I think has captained Brazil before, will play. Arsenal will be a little bit weaker than Chelsea. Chelsea's reserve team is more than good enough to... Reserve team's not quite the right phrase, is it? Second string is what Mourinho will pull out. He'll use it to give the squad men a chance. But this isn't going to be two teams of kids going against each other. It's not the same as when West Ham put the kids out or Bolton put the kids out. This is going to be two teams full of internationals. They might not be first choice internationals at their clubs, but they are still fully international players who are of ultimate pedigree, apart from Nicholas Bentner. Who I think will probably play for Arsenal, which may well make the difference if Bentner plays, Arsenal will lose. But no, it'll be... Mourinho doesn't like to lose. Whatever he says, whatever competition it's in, he doesn't like to lose, and he particularly won't like to lose to Arsene Wenger. So I'm sure that he will want the same attitude from a different set of players tonight.
There's a fair few games I want to quickly cover from the weekend with you, Rory, just before we let you go. Sunderland against Newcastle. We've seen this all before, haven't we? Sunderland taking on Newcastle with a new manager and winning. I mean, is it going to be the same old, or is this have a different feel to the kick-on that Di Canio got from winning St. James's
Park? I don't know. I'm inclined to agree with the first assessment rather than the latter. I think it's very, very dangerous to read too much into a derby win, because the emotions are high and everything's very pressurised and intense. And I think, we always used to say that if it's passed into cliche, but the form book goes out the window in derbies, and I think that applies both beforehand and afterwards. It will give Sunderland a boost this week, but if they don't lose at the weekend badly, then it will all be undone. The key really is for Sunderland to kick on and start picking up points relatively frequently. The problem they've got is that they've not got that many good players. The manager was an issue that the atmosphere Di Canio created, and Poirier is an upgrade. I think make it a lot calmer, a lot more kind of, unified. But the problem is that if you look through that side, there's not many players who'll get in anyone else's team. And that's the crux of the issue at Sunderland.
Is there more pressure now on Pardew because of that loss than there is on Gus Poyet at this moment in time, though, up on Tyneside?
Yeah, I don't think there's any pressure on Poyet. Obviously, he's just started. It was a poor result against Swansea in his first game, but that will buy him time. And I'm sure he'll be given time at Sunderland, whatever happens. And even if they were to get relegated, I'd expect him still to be in charge. I think that's maybe partly why they were keen on him, was just, he knows how to get out, well, he doesn't know how to get out of the Championship, but he knows how to manage in the Championship. He knows what the Championship is all about. I think Sunderland, that's quite an intelligent appointment. Pardew's in a really sort of strange position because you've got Joe Kinnear kind of behind the scenes who clearly wants to be manager. It's all gone quiet at the moment. But all you need at Newcastle is two or three bad results and Ashley might do something slightly stupid and sack Pardew and appoint Joe Kinnear. And it's a very, very strange time at Newcastle and I'm not sure that it's healthy. In fact, I'm certain it's not healthy. Whether Ashley will do that, we can't be certain because no one knows what Mike Ashley's thinking. You sometimes get the impression Mike Ashley's not desperately sure what Mike Ashley's thinking. There is now pressure on Pardew, though. There's no question about that. He needs to kind of... Newcastle don't look like they're the sum of their parts at the moment. They've got some good players, Newcastle, but they're just not quite clicking. And Pardew needs to sort that out pretty quickly.
Is that in part because of the off-field problems that have taken place with the appointment of Kinnear and what's happened? Or is this Pardew losing his way in the dressing room slightly?
Well, I think it's probably partly the off-field shenanigans is the official term, I think. But then if you look back, it goes that they were very poor last season, very disappointing last season in Newcastle. And increasingly, it looks like that year when they finished fifth was an exception rather than the rule, which is a shame because, as I say, if you look through their side, they've got some really good players. They've scouted brilliantly. They've signed players for, below market rate who are now worth substantially more. They should be much higher than they are in the table. But it looks like whether the players don't quite believe in what's happening at the club, whether the uncertainty is kind of seeping through to the dressing room, whether Pardew's just not that good a manager, something has happened that means Newcastle are not currently performing as they should be.
Keeping it in the north just quickly, Rory, Manchester United with that 3-2 win, come from behind win against Stoke as well. Is the manner of that win going to give them more confidence going into Norwich and the fact they came from behind this week, or will it actually be detrimental because they've scraped a win against Stoke at home?
No, I think it'll be positive because it's that old United thing, isn't it? It's coming from behind, snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. And I think that's I was there at Old Trafford on Saturday, and that felt significant. It felt like a genuine Manchester United moment. Like that spirit that they've always had is still there, whatever the change of regime. And I think that is genuinely important. And it's really important for Moyes that he saw that. What that doesn't, or what that shouldn't disguise, I guess, is that they didn't play very well. Certainly for 75 minutes, they were very poor against Stoke. And to be honest, Stoke should have been out of sight at half-time. They could have been 3 or 4-0 up at half-time, which would have been, humiliating for Manchester United. And I think, it's a funny one, that just the overall effect of winning is positive without question. The performance, though, I would say is still probably a negative. I wasn't impressed with United at all in the first 20 minutes. Is the worst I've ever seen them play, without question. So there are still problems there. But I think that knowing they can still do that will kind of stand them in good stead as they try and rectify this fairly poor start to the season they've had.
And finally, Rory, the SAS were back in action again for Liverpool against West Bromwich Albion. Suarez and Sturridge together look a great combo. How impressed are you by Brendan Rodgers, that he's been able to keep the two up front and work a system behind that still works for Liverpool?
Yeah, I think what was significant this weekend with Liverpool was that for the first time they played for 90 minutes, it wasn't a sort of 45-minute performance then clinging on desperately or sort of playing in flashes. And that's because you had a midfield of three midfielders, not two midfielders and Victor Moses, who's a good player, but he's a winger, playing as the number 10. And it doesn't suit him, that role, at all. On Saturday against West Brom, you had Gerrard, Lucas and Jordan Henderson. And for all that, Lucas and Henderson probably aren't kind of the darlings of the media or players that people rate particularly highly, or even to be honest, if we're completely frank about it, they're not the world's greatest footballers, but they give that midfield a really nice balance, and they let Suarez and Sturridge go and do what they do. And I've got something that I thought at the start of the season, that being in contention for fourth would represent significant progress for Liverpool this year. I don't think they can stay the course in the title race, but if Suarez and Sturridge stay at the club and stay fit, they will score so many goals. I don't see how you can shut them both down. even if one of them gets injured, Liverpool are pretty effective with just either Suarez or Sturridge, especially when Coutinho's back. So I think Liverpool are genuine contenders to finish in the Champions League places this year. And it just goes to show, you know, how important having one element of your team that is better than everybody else's in that area really can be. The Suarez and Sturridge will strike so much fear into every defence. They're at Arsenal at the weekend, Liverpool. And Arsenal have been excellent this season. But you wouldn't, if you're Laurent Koscielny and Per Mertesacker, you wouldn't fancy keeping Suarez and Sturridge quiet for 90 minutes because no one else can.
And I suppose that's why Luis Suarez has still made that 23-man list for the Ballon d'Or. Has he got a chance to make it into the top 10 even with his bad reputation?
Top 10 maybe, although I wouldn't be sure. I'm not quite sure what he'd have done on a global stage to warrant it. I think in terms of winning it, it surely will be Messi, although really it should be a Bayern Munich player, I would have thought, this year. It's a funny one, the Ballon d'Or list, the same with the Manager of the Year list. I'm not quite sure what the criteria are or what you kind of need to do to win it, because obviously Messi is the best footballer on the planet. No one would argue with that. So should he win it because he's the best footballer on the planet, despite the fact that he didn't, you know, win the Champions League this year? He's not done anything with Argentina particularly this year. Should it go to a player who kind of helped a club overachieve, even if that player individually isn't the greatest player in the world? It's a very strange kind of award. I'm not quite sure what FIFA mean by the Ballon d'Or, but if I had to put money on it, I'd say Messi.
I think we're all gunning for Frank Ribery and think Diego Simeone should have been in that managerial list as well, Rory, but we'll continue that debate later on in the show. For now, though, we appreciate you coming on here and having a chat with us about all things English football. Enjoy the Capital One Cup tonight, mate, and we look forward to catching up with you very soon indeed.
Always a pleasure, mate. Take care.
Cheers, Rory. Rory Smith there joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things English Premier League football. Rory of the Times, you can follow at Rory Smith Times on Twitter. He's a really nice chap, I have to say. I met him a couple of times down at some of the grounds over the last few years, and always a chap who's more than happy to say hello and have a quick natter with you about all things football and everything else as well. A big game, obviously, tonight, Arsenal against Chelsea. The London Derby rivalry continues. Mourinho against Wenger continues as well. Before we move away and get Rafa Gonzalez on the show, just a few quick facts for you about the Arsenal-Chelsea game coming up this evening.